Kevin Harlan here. Tonight at 5:30 Eastern, the NBA on Prime Crew is back as the Emirates NBA action heats up from Vegas for a thrilling semifinals doubleheader. Then on Tuesday night, December 16th at 8:30 Eastern, the last two teams standing will square off in the championship game for a shot at the cup, bragging rights, and a place in NBA history. And Prime is your exclusive home for it all. Not a Prime member? Sign up for a free 30-day trial to get started today. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/Amazon Prime for details. Don't miss the thrilling conclusion of the Emirates NBA Cup live from Las Vegas, starting with the semifinals tonight, only on Prime.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
Will they find a home? Sponsored by Geico. Steve is intrigued by the paranormal.
Otherworldly spirits really make a house a home, you know?
Janice has different taste.
I'd like my house to not be haunted.
Compromise is tough, but these two won't have to compromise when they bundle home and car insurance with Geico. It's easy, and they could save even more. In the end, Steve and Janice found a renovated Victorian that's only haunted from 9 to 5.
Okay, wife's home. Y'all gotta bounce.
Bye, Steve.
Bundling without compromise at Geico.com.
Pat, you're in your mid-20s, and...
I'm a little older than that right now.
I'm sorry.
You mean... Thank you, though. Yes. I know. I use a moisturizer.
Let me rephrase that. In the 1980s, you're...
What?
Back in Pennsylvania, where you grew up, and you are a budding, serious songwriter.
Yep. Three sets of the serious stuff. Then I would do one set of covers, mostly Beatle covers. And I would do Billy Joel, Only the Good Die Young or something.
Okay.
Any audience kind of a lively number. Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyards or whatever.
Yeah.
But I would not do what everybody else did. I would not do American Pie, which gets the whole bar singing. And I hate the song.
You hate the song.
I hate the guy who sings it because he's always denied. Basically, the lyrical imagery in that song, he's talking about these 60s artists and he's knocking them. But history proved that those 60s artists were really pretty good. So his remarks about the Beatles and Dylan thinly veiled in his horrible, ambiguous poetry. I've always hated that song.
See, I had no idea that he was being critical in that song.
Because he's denied it. He still does. But it's just so obvious. I've seen breakdowns of the song and it's just hilarious, you know.
No kidding.
Cody borrowed from James Dean and all this stuff was just, he was really kind of being snotty about the 60s and of history. History has proved that that stuff was pretty good.
Because everybody says it's a tribute.
No, he doesn't mean it like that.
He doesn't?
No.
Would somebody argue with you?
They would. Yeah. And then working at the station in Wilkes-Barre, I'm working there 5 days a week. They then opened up this other part of this nightclub area for music acts to come through, like your Warren Zevon. So I had a chance to work with Warren Zevon. And then later on in radio, I would perform with Warren Zevon and kind of befriended one of my favorite songwriters of all time. It was a great opportunity. David Bromberg, I opened up for the band at this place, and they were delightfully drugged up and crazy and fun.
Yeah.
But Danko invited me up to New York, and I would go up there and hang out with him. And I was a part of that whole scene. When I opened up for people, I would be in the green room, and I would meet them. I would hung out with Richard Manuel, the keyboard player, 2 weeks before he passed away in Florida.
Wow.
So I had I'm like Zelig. I'm in the weird moment at the right time, so to speak. And I'm able to now see the people that I admire, Dave Mason, and all. I'm able to open for them, and because I was the guy. I was the guy who did original music, and they didn't want to cover a kid doing, you know, American Pie, or they wanted somebody, you know, to do a 20 minutes. They didn't want the guy at a bar, and I was that writer in my little neck of the woods, so to speak.
So you were the go-to opener for these acts.
The go-to guy. Yeah.
And you're getting paid and making a living?
I'm making a living. I mean, I'm not killing it, but I'm learning my craft.
Right.
And I'm surviving, and I'm sleeping with every waitress that works there. And I'm, you know.
Where are you living?
I was probably living in an apartment with one of my buddies at that time.
Okay, yeah.
Or had girlfriends and stuff. I had a girlfriend, Kim. All of my girlfriends and wives are named Kim. Right. The first Kim, who came from Indiana, came with me to Pennsylvania. So she was my girlfriend for 5 years. And then when I started to perform and stuff, we just sort of broke up. And then I became a very reckless and wild and horny young man. Best time of my life.
You're a young musician. Ample opportunity to meet.
I had David Cassidy hair, and I was ripped. I still had my high school bod, which I've waved goodbye to.
Oh, it's in there somewhere.
It's still there. Yeah, it's just it's hiding under the blubber. So
I used to have a line in my act that said, "I have a great body underneath my body."
Well, I had an added fat joke. I do what I've done on the show. And I forget. I gained all the. Oh, I forgot what the freaking joke was. Let me. Let's move on.
Oh, okay.
Sure. I forgot what the joke was.
I don't worry. I often forget many of your jokes.
They are instantly forgettable. You know what? That just reminds me that I have a gig coming up, and I better look at the game tape and relearn my act.
Yeah.
We're going to start performing again, and that was a good example. There's a little line I had in my act that is completely gone. those little trinkets, we call them, in between
right.
bits.
Right.
You have to relearn where they go.
Yes.
And, jeez. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm writing this down. Look at videotape before next gig. Yeah.
So didn't you end up doing some sort of work with Don McLean?
Yeah, well, Don McLean came through, and Jerry Siss, the owner of the station, said, "Do you want to open up for Don McLean?" I said,
So you're not a fan at all?
I hate him. Yeah. I've seen him interviewed about the song, and I go, "Oh, yes." Because it's going to be packed. It'll be good. And I had the record Circle City was just being played on local radio. KRZ was the first to break it, so I had what was called a regional hit.
Yeah.
They do the local guy a favor, and they play his song, and he gets to feel like a big shot in his own little area.
It's great.
It is great.
Yeah.
And that trickled down into Philly, and we got some good airplay. And it's actually, I'll play it for you sometime. It's a very sweet little moody, interesting chord changes song.
Is it out there for anyone to listen to?
Yeah, it's on. There's a YouTube video of me doing Circle City at King's College, which is really kind of cool. It's a neat little song. It's very original sounding, and I'm surprised that I even wrote it, because it just, I look at it now, and it's intricate, and it's thoughtful, and I go, geez. It surprises me even now to look at that song.
I love when that happens.
Yeah.
I recently looked at a short story I wrote back in college.
Right.
And I was in advanced creative writing. And I was considered pretty good or whatever.
Right.
And I read it and I went, who wrote this?
Yeah, I know.
I love when that happens. It's a weird thing.
When you put the work in and you're so passionate about stuff, then you get away from it. You go back, you look, you go, well, some of it, that's crap. But then you go, whoa.
Exactly.
That's really good.
That's exactly what it was. It was like mining for, like you could, like a pan for gold.
Sifting through.
Yeah, you go, oh my gosh, there was some really good, I can see why my professor liked me or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and coming from a theatrical, intellectual background, too, I look back at some of the lyrics. I go, oh, geez, that's really pretty good. I don't know why after doing comedy you sort of like don't, you know, because, you know, now we're getting laughs. And that still is a very intellectual process.
Yes.
But when I look back at these early original songs, a few of them go, well, geez.
Yeah.
There was another one I saw that I sent to my ex-wife even because I thought she'd like to hear a 22-year-old me. It was called One Past Way Too Many. Great jazz chord changes. And she's like, Jesus, how old are you? I said, 22 years old.
Yeah.
This guy. I'm singing like I'm Tom. I wasn't singing like Tom Waits, but right. It was the wisdom.
Yeah.
Of One Past Way Too Many. And I was,
Title's wise.
How does a 22-year-old get this kind
exactly.
of alcoholic insight? Oh, geez, I wonder where.
But you got, well, exactly. Yeah. You got it. But yeah.
So I get the opportunity, so to speak, to open up for Don McLean. And I go, all my buddies are going to be there.
Yeah.
So all my friends, all the music guys, Parkey, Tim Cross, all my buddies are going to be there. And I'm going, well, this is going to be exciting. I mean, and my little 20 minutes was serious, but I would have funny stuff in. And I closed with a song called Cemetery Girls, which was a sing-along, which is really a funny, very broad song. My first broad, funny song.
Okay.
He has a little mini band. He's got like a drummer. He's got a guitar player and a bass player, which kind of surprised me. I thought it was a solo thing. He had a little band. And I go into the green room. We're all supposed to be in the green room. And I forgot my guitar tuner. So I say to one of the guitar player, hey, do you mind if I borrow your guitar tuner? And he's just the nicest guy in the world.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, man. Yeah. Hey, good to have you on board. Well, have fun tonight. And I'm tuning my guitar, and in walks Don McLean. And I'm like, oh, it's Don McLean. And he is just staring. He staring a hole right through me. He goes, "What are you doing in here?" I said, "Oh, Mr. McLean, I'm your opening act, and what's your name?" He goes, my name is Pat." He goes, "Well, Pat," and that's when a little switch.
Yeah, yeah.
"Well, Pat, I want you to leave. I don't want you back here. This is our area." I said, "Well, I've opened up for a lot of people back here, and oh, have you?" That's how this is starting off. We haven't even met.
Right.
And he goes, "Well, I would just be more comfortable if you just left. You know, if you just, you know, you got," and I looked at him. I said, "You got to be kidding me. There's no other place to kind of do. This is the green room. I'll go over here and not bother you." No, we are having an altercation.
Yeah.
And his band is like, they're, one of them is giggling because they've never seen anyone stand up to this douchebag. And I said, "And by the way, American Pie sucks."
So you're just going right for the jugs.
You could have written a bridge. I mean, it just goes on and on. You know, and they're getting giggles, and he's mad. But I did it in a way that I was just being a little bit of a smartass. I think I opened up with, you could have used a bridge, you know. But he didn't take it that way. His band did, though. I mean, you just go on and on. It was my little way of, because I'm packing up my guitar and I'm out. And yeah. I am livid.
Yeah.
But by the time, if the next 5-10 minutes I'm being introduced and I go to myself, "Well, you have 20 minutes and all your friends are out there. You need to get..." But I'm Irish, and this when I get mad, sometimes that burner stays on.
Mm-hmm.
And that burner was on when I hit the stage. And I opened up with Circle City, which they would applaud at the beginning of it. And I opened up with like the only kind of semi-hit I had. And this is not really killing them because it's a really moody song. It's a ballad, you know. So and I'm like, "Oh, this was a bad way to open." Because my mind isn't in the game.
Yeah.
I should have opened with something lively. So then right after Circle City, I go, "You know what just happened?" And I tell the whole story. "By the way, you're about to see one of the biggest asses." And I tell the whole story. And my peeps, my friends are dying that I'm being such. I said, "Yeah, Don McLean. And what's he going to do? Starry Night halfway through and then close with American Pie." And then, of course, he is. "I hope you all enjoy it." They're howling. But they're there to see Don McLean.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of Wilkes-Barre, Scranton friends there. And I go about my way, and after every third song, I like we do in comedy. If you get like a little audience moment, you do a little callback to it.
Yeah,
you know, and that's what I was doing. I go, "By the way, did I tell you the guy you're about to see?" And they would howl. So then I do Cemetery Girls, and I leave myself 2 minutes because I had an idea. I go, "You know what? We all know he's going to close with American Pie. I am so mad right now. What do you say I F up his closing, and I'll sing American Pie right now? We all know it, right?" And I launch into I'm making up, you know, "Bye bye, Don McLean is a dick." And they're singing along, and I see this shadowy figure. Because at the station there were these little steps that went up to the dressing room. And now he is out. And but the audience can't see him, but I know that he's there on the stairs. Right? So So the crowd's dying. I said, "I hope you enjoy Don McLean. Good night." People clapping. They've just seen something. They've never seen an opening act just totally ruin ever opening for anybody again. And I walk up the stairs, and I'm going to have to curse, and you can bleep this, but this is what I actually said.
Yeah.
I walk up the stairs, and I look at him, and I went, "Hey, don't f*** with me in my hometown." And he said nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing. He said nothing. And then he went on stage and he never addressed it. And my friends to this day, they go, "That was, I've never seen someone flame out."
And how did he do?
He did fine. He's Don McLean. He did fine. Yeah. And they loved American Pie.
They wanted to, exactly.
He destroyed. I didn't put a dent.
I wonder if he knew he would be just fine.
Of course he did. And, you know, okay. I've written the story down, and I haven't published it, but I put it on Facebook. And there was a guy who opened for him for 6 months who ended up teaching music somewhere who responded to me. And then he printed his nightmare of 6 months opening for Don McLean.
Wow.
And it was the same thing. He goes, "Pat, you couldn't have said it more, you know." And he says he was so rude to me.
It's such a bummer to hear.
Yeah.
Now, you weren't. I know you, and I know other, and I know how performers are. You weren't mad that he asked for you to leave the green room per se. You were mad the way he did it.
Is it?
There are ways to do that. There are ways to go.
you know, everybody has, we all respect people backstage in their process. Some people are quiet and some people are very chatty. And we all, you know, and I can be both. If I like you, I'm too chatty. If I don't like you as a comedian, I'm quiet. So I understand that process. If somebody in management or even Don says, hey, you know what, I get into a thing and I got to be by myself. Is it, do you mind? And I would have gone, oh, no. Totally get it.
Yeah.
I do not mind because, you know, I go either way. Sometimes I need to be left alone to focus on my act and pace. And sometimes I don't mind being chatty if, like, that's – it was the way it was handled.
Yeah. I was working the Richmond Funny Bone, and John Witherspoon was the headliner.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how great he is.
Yeah, he's a sweet guy, yeah.
Yeah, and hilarious. And the manager came up to me and he said – hey, you can't go in the green room this weekend. John wants it all to himself. And he said, I don't think he's being a diva. I think he's being a 70-year-old man.
Sure.
And I went, it's John Witherspoon. He can happily, I'd be happy to not be in the green room or whatever. Let him have his space. He's more than earned it.
Yeah.
Well, so it didn't, and he ended up giving me one of my all-time favorite, I had a really sweet moment with him. It was, we did the whole week, and then the last show, the second show Saturday, every show was sold out.
Yeah.
And I was walking off stage, and he was walking towards the stage, and he goes, you're funny.
Oh,
and
wow.
And I said, oh, John, thank you so much. I didn't realize you were – I called him Mr. Witherspoon. I said, Mr. Witherspoon, thank you so much. I didn't realize you were watching. He goes, no, I wasn't watching. I heard.
Oh.
And some people would, I think, would go, oh, he didn't watch your act? No. That meant
a lot.
He heard the audience and he knew that it went okay. So
people do have their process. They like I poke in. I want to know what the person before me is doing so that I don't step on something. And if we have a similar premise, then as a headliner, you move a different way.
Yes.
But I have a very hard time. I poke in and out, but I do the work. Whenever I haven't done the work, you get your ass handed to you. If you're cocky backstage, or you get too full of yourself because you've been killing for a while, you're going to have a bad show. You can never underestimate it. So I will always always listen for the laughter, poke my head in.
Yeah.
Everybody has their way of doing a good show.
Same here.
So I saw Kevin Pollak. His process was he could not bear. I saw Nick Griffin open for him, and Kevin Pollak would waltz in right before he went on, because that was his process and everybody respected it. But I saw him do and not get laughs with similar Nick Griffin premises that were better written on Nick's part. And then Kevin probably didn't understand why it wasn't working, because part of his process didn't want to hear the opening act.
I don't like seeing the audience at all before I go on. So my first, because I incorrectly assume things.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah.
If there, let's say there's an older couple, you know, in their 70s in the front, I'll go, oh, they're not going to like some of the bluer material.
Yeah.
This is going to, and then I'm always wrong. I'm always wrong.
Always.
Those folks loved the raunchier stuff or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? And so I don't like to do that, but for the first show. But the second show, I always want to watch however, if I'm middling, and I see that a headliner has a similar premise or bit, I think it's my job as the middle to back off my bit. Then the headliner shouldn't have to make adjustments. I should.
Well, it's funny. When anybody's come up to me and asked me, he goes, hey, is there anything I close with a music piece? I said, I want you to do whatever you do, and it's my job to adjust. And guys will go, oh. Wow, thank you.
I do that now,
too.
Yeah,
of course.
But if I'm a middle, I feel like it's my responsibility.
Oh, no, yeah.
If when I'm headlining,
it's your responsibility to at least ask.
Right. When I'm headlining, I let them do whatever they want.
And they can't believe I allow them. And can
Same here.
Can I sell merch? Of course you can sell merch.
Yes.
Because I'm not. I'm out of here. I'm out of personality when I'm done. I'm horrible selling merch.
Oh, I'm not good at pushing my merch. But I like saying hi. So
you know, it's funny what you say about looking at an audience, because I am a looker. I'm a kind of a...
I know you are. I have talked about
it. Oh, I got a thing. When I first started working the ships, it threw me that everyone was older, and because I'm used to the kids in the clubs and a wider demographic. Then with the Bob and Tom shows, it was skewered even more, you know, older, but not cruise ship old.
Right, right.
So it's my first adult show on one of the Royal Caribbean tours, and I look out at the crowd. I'm like, oh. And we were in St. Thomas, where you can use your phone. So we had an early show that was I still had cell service. It's very important when you work with cruise ships, getting your cell service. So St. Thomas has American service. So I remember looking at the crowd. I go, they're ancient. And I thought I'd check in with Tom Griswold, the guy we work with. I go, oh, my God. Yeah, I can't believe how old these people are. He goes, really? Yeah, how old you are? I said, do you know they were all at Woodstock? I said, all those white-haired people that you're, they're going to understand what you're doing. Don't hold back. They've been young. They've lived a life. They're not going to be timid. You're going to do fine. Don't give them the show you're supposed to give them. He's made a comment. They were all at Woodstock. You know, they weren't all Woodstock.
Right,
but the point he was making is they had their boobs out. And, worried about, you know, they were wilder than you are.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
They just look 20 exactly. years older than I do. You know?
Exactly. We're right. That's the thing. Like I said, the assumptions I make are wrong.
Yeah. And sometimes you can look at a drunk, chatty table and go, and then they're the most focused.
Exactly.
You can't, yeah.
Exactly.
I always set myself up for disaster that way. I'm just so thrilled when the show turns out. I am I'm negative before. I'm cranky sometimes.
Pat, you and I have done plenty of shows together, and you're pacing. There are times where it looks like you're at an open mic.
I don't know why I'm in this business because I've lost my central nervous system. I am anxious, and I have anxiety issues to begin with. So when you throw. I can feel my blood pressure rise. I said, I've done this so much. You would think I would have some, but I am a pacing. I'm like, what am I could throw this thing in? I got to get
yeah.
it. I'm like, you know, I still have that 20-year-old ambition and anxiety. And I always thought it was bad until I saw a documentary on Carson
mm-hmm.
where it was this, like his last week. And they showed him backstage.
Yeah.
And they were interviewing him. And he was like, he does some weird thing with the curtain. And he's like, And somebody said, are you still nervous? Okay. And he said to the camera or the guy doing the documentary, yeah, you know, if I wasn't nervous, I would be worried.
Same here.
That's what he said. And I went, oh.
Wow, I had no idea. He said, I've always felt like if you're not at the very least a little nervous, something's not right.
I saw a Judy Garland documentary, and I won't use the F word this time, but she did. They showed her right before the show. Her daughter was talking about her before show. She goes, oh, my God. It's no wonder that she would sometimes over-medicate herself because she just suffered before shows. And she was so good. But, and she would grab the curtain. And her thing, her mantra before she would go on stage was, but she'd say the F word. She'd go, F them, F them, F them, F them. And she would pull on the curtain. And then she'd be introduced.
Yeah.
And my brother and I, right before shows, let's F this big.
Anything to kind of go, okay.
Yeah.
That's you always make me laugh.
I pace like I'm about to have a baby.
More than once, some of us will be, you know, Greg Hahn will be joking around with us or whatever, or whatever's going on. And because I'm not. I try to stay kind of even keeled mm-hmm. when I'm before I go on, so I'll come with you. Hey Pat, and I'll joke with you, and you go, you'll laugh, and then go, okay, I'm sorry, I have to. I have to. It's like you want to play along, but you're getting ready.
I never knew how bad I was.
It makes me laugh every time though that you're so honest about it. You go, hey look, I can't.
I never knew how bad I was until I was working. In Sanibel, Florida, for my buddy John Biddle, and I love this club, and it was so beautiful to be in that area, and I'd go there a couple times a year just to hang. I love the guy John Biddle too, and he had everybody through there. You know, you named Jimmy Schubert. This was it was a one headliner format.
Mm-hmm.
And they had John would do 5 minutes up front.
Okay,
he loved comedy, but he, you know,
yeah,
but he was a student of comedy, and he loved comedians, and he's the most generous guy. Even to this day, he's one guy who will call me every other week just to check in. But we were having a conversation pre-show, and I just said to him, God, you've seen everybody come through here, huh? You must have some stories, people, the way the people prepare for a show. Because, you know, I tell you, I get a little, you know, anxious. And he didn't say anything.
Yeah.
And I went, who is like the person who's really good, but like they're a mess before the show? And he goes, you. it shocked me. I was like, what? And he said something like, you're so talented. And You would think you were about to do your first open mic. Right. Why are you pacing? And and even on the road after 2 weeks or something, I would sometimes, and very unfortunately, a second show, I would just to relieve that, I would do a shot. I would do a shot and maybe nurse a beer, you know. I knew never to not do that because I had family issues. I have my own issues. I didn't want to perform like that. Certainly afterwards, I would tear it up from time to time and too much at times, but I would start to do that. And I found early that I was funny like that. And boy, what a fool's gold that is. Yes. To do a shot of a hooch and then just be like my uncle, reckless at a wedding. Hey, you know, and that anxiety goes away. And now that the devil's out, you know?
Right. I've never tried to dampen the anxiety before a show.
Yeah, and I did, and I was, the funny thing is that you're effective in the beginning, and then it's the law of diminishing returns.
Yeah.
Then you have the one show where you're over the line, and you're like, holy Jesus. Because I've worked with so many people that I've seen trip and fall on stage and forget their acts.
It's hard to watch.
It is hard to watch.
Yeah.
Road comedy's hard, and it really takes its toll, the boredom, the loneliness. And I understand why I and other people, you know, would just get themselves in tough positions, because it's a lonely ride, you know. And I've seen people cross the line, and it's sad to watch.
Yeah, it's hard. Yeah. It's hard because you're not just watching. When you see somebody perform like that, you're not watching, oh, he's drunk. You're watching, oh, he's been on the road and he's sad, and there's it's everything that you just said.
It's all there.
Visible.
Yep, it's all there.
Yeah.
I remember performing after my dad's, I missed my dad's memorial because my dad's motto would have been the show goes on. So I was obviously at the funeral and everything. But then they cremated him and they had a second memorial. Mm-hmm. And I had to work. I couldn't, it was actually the place that we tease you about in Toledo where I was on stage, impaired second show, and I was falling apart at the seams. I was talking about my dad, and when I was getting divorced, I was always pretty funny on stage because my friends would love to see me perform during the breakups. They say, oh God, I would love to watch you you'd be just insane talking about her for 20 minutes and just killing, you know. But when my dad passed away, it was different because there was nothing funny about that. And I'm on stage talking about it. And,
yeah.
Oh man, that did not go well.
Well, we'll probably hit that a little harder coming up here.
Sure.
So, let's see. Some of this we might cut and then move to.
Oh, sure.
When we're talking more stand-up stuff. So where did we kind of go timeline-wise?
Well, Todd Glass got me to do the open mic. Todd Glass, finally after 2 years of cajoling and hanging out with me and being like, his presence on stage was fantastic. He was just a bold guy. I used to watch him do comedy and go, God, I could. He just had it.
Yeah.
He was a student of it. He started when he was 16 at the Comedy Works in Philly. And this is before Todd goes to L.A. And he drags me to an open mic. It's at the Comedy Factory Outlet. And this is run by John DiBella, the morning guy at WMMR, which is the biggest radio station, AOR station in the country. It won a bunch of awards. They're still there. Same people are still there. And DiBella is, of course, in a duel with Howard Stern and beating him handily. The Morning Zoo is huge, and he's the host
of
the open mic. And Todd goes, look, just be yourself. You put your little impressions together. The voice is going to get the laugh, and just be yourself. So I did Billy Joel. I did a Tom Petty. I did a Michael McDonald. I just strung 7 or 8 things together, and sometimes you get lucky on your first time out there. And here's how DiBella introduced me. I've done a lot of these open mics, and these guys with guitars, they're either really good or they suck. So let's see if this guy sucks. Pat Godwin. This is the guy I end up working with.
Yeah.
And I strung some impressions together without any jokes. I think I would mumble, Tom Petty, oh, that's a lyric. That was like the hook. I would do affectations of Van Morrison or that's a lyric. But for some reason, it got a laugh.
Sure.
Because the impression was really strong at that time. Because I focused on him. Now I'm just like kind of content heavy and not focusing sometimes on the impression. And Tom will often tell me, hey, lose the impression. We can't hear what you know. So I do a mixture. But back then I was trying to nail it. And then DiBella, like it worked. Oh, yeah, 5 minutes. I did, He could tell that I was a musician too, and he was like really impressed by the craft, but I was not a comedian.
Yeah.
And he says to me, "Hey, you think you can do these funny songs like on a regular basis?" And I lied. I said, "Yes." Show up on Monday, and I had a radio gig.
Wow.
Yeah. And I went, "What?" Yeah. And in the beginning, I would just do little studio things, and then they turned out to be really good because I just focused on comedy writing. And they were, I wanted it to be all original in the beginning. And he was fine with that. But then, because he knew I did the voices, he would shift me to the side of the devil, the parody side, you know. And I've never been one to think of parodies, even though we'll take a quick one and do them on our show now, obviously. Yeah. It's not where my mind goes first. But this is, you know, it's kind of like my day job. They work for radio in that limited function.
Mm-hmm.
And DiBella also knew, you know, where his bread was buttered. You know, you did that Billy Joel thing. You think you can do a little thing? Yeah, yeah, I can do that. And I started to then get a better salary. And then come on board full time.
All from your first open mic.
First open mic.
Wow.
And I went back and did my second open mic that Keith Robinson hosted, and I ate it.
Do you think almost everybody I've talked to, and this is definitely my experience, my first open mic, I did really well, and the second, ate it. Hard.
It was terrible.
And for those of maybe same material, same stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I started to add what I thought were funny songs, and I didn't have a grasp of that yet. I was not in front of people to get laughs. I was getting laughs on my own terms in controlled environments that I controlled for 4 hours. I wasn't, hey, you got 5 minutes, laugh. That pressure, like, oh, God, that was tough on me because I was a guy who'd sneak up on you in the club, but I was not a five-minute comedian, and to this day, I'm really still not.
Yeah,
but man, I think I ate it the next three times because Clay Heary would say, the guy who ran this club, the Comedy Factory outlet, he would say, you know, come back for, now that you're on the show, you'll come back for open mics. And man, I was going, I was eating it.
It's a good thing. It's the way I think, I kind of look at it as the comedy gods going, all right, so you go out for your first time, you kill, and then, and part of you wants to go, oh, well, I got this.
Yeah.
What's so hard about this? And then when you bomb that second time, and then a lot of even the third, it's the comedy gods going, no, this is work. You're not. This isn't an easy ride.
Well, this club also is the easiest club in the country. It's where Dice came up, Tim Allen, everybody. I mean, this club was the premier club of Philly. Harry Anderson would come through with his magic act.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw all those guys at that time before they had TV shows. Seinfeld, everybody came through this club. It was tiny and had like little Greek seating.
I bet it was great.
You had to be pretty crappy, like my second open mic. I got lucky that first one because the crowd was easy. And, you know, that Billy Joel was dead on. And I had no content. So
yeah.
when you strip the veneer of the impression away, like that's the second time I tried to, you know, to talk a little more. That didn't go well. So then
So you're doing the radio. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Then I had this radio gig that, you know, it's like you write a check with no money in the bank. And then hopefully you think, well, the money will come in. So, you know, it was a very reckless thing to say yes, but probably the best decision of my life because, oh, God, the laughter was just so much better entertainment-wise than playing the serious music in the clubs. I got more of a kick out of how hard it was and how good I was getting at it by the more I started to understand the process and respect it.
Yeah, so you're learning radio and stand-up at the same time.
With major cats, though. I mean,
yeah.
This show, every day, I mean, I think my second week, Billy Crystal was in Seinfeld, Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, these people were just coming up in the business at the time.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking 89-90 when I started with them. And this show had some major power to it. I mean, I got an okay salary just for doing a couple songs, which actually was the first time I was ever employed or it was paying into Social Security and stuff. It was just kind of interesting for this kind of wandering troubadour. All
right.
Of a sudden, I have a gig.
Yeah.
And it's a gig like on a big level. Shirley MacLaine is there. And, you know, it's like every day is something because Philly is the fourth largest market. And we had these huge guests, you know.
Are they coming in or are they on the phone or both?
No phone. We didn't do phoners. People came in. John DiBella rarely, unless it was like his favorite Peter Gabriel or something.
Yeah.
But we would have the Grateful Dead was big. One of them would all went wandering. Brian Wilson came in. This is what my experience was. It was all of a sudden I was in in this situation.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you rise to the occasion when you're in that situation. I would spend just the rest of the day. We all had an agreement with each other that none of us who were all partiers at this time would touch a drop of alcohol until the weekend. And that was our agreement with each, with everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's the way it was, because we said we're in the big leagues. Stern is nipping at our tails. It was his first syndicated market. And we had would show up for a meeting at 5. We were all kind of taxied or limoed to our job. It was very cushy.
Yeah.
And because Stern was huge at this time in New York, and we were his first syndicated market, and he was gunning for DiBella.
Yeah.
The stakes were high. And I just thought, man, I don't even belong here. I'm not even a comedian. I just wrote my ass off and would come in at the meeting at 5 o'clock, tell him what I had. And, you know, he did what Tom and I kind of do. DiBella didn't write or edit like Tom and I will do that together.
Yeah.
But he would like, nah, yeah, nah, you know, that kind of a thing.
Okay.
And then I would probably do a song a break or something or an hour. We also played four rock and roll songs. So we didn't have the kind of show that we have now. With the Bob and Tom.
Yeah.
We had a very cornball morning show with the prank phone calls, and I would do my little song, and mm-hmm. then we'd play four rock and roll songs an hour or two. So there was time to write also in those moments. You know, there was downtime.
Yeah.
So really pretty cool, though.
How many years did you do that?
Six. Yeah, six.
So and are you hitting the road doing stand-up at the same time, or are you just
absolutely,
all local?
Absolutely not. Okay. I would do a Friday and Saturday at the Comedy Cabaret, the Comedy Factory Outlets, maybe something in Baltimore because that was an hour and a half drive.
Yeah.
Wilmington, half hour, you know, things like that. I would just Friday and Saturday, we'd meet back at my place. We would drink our asses off. We'd rehab on Sunday, back to work on Monday. It was just, you know, we were like these weekend warriors. And in that period of time, I got pushed up to be a headliner. And I didn't have 45 minutes. I had songs that I was accumulating, but I did not have any finesse or, you know, I had some presence on stage, but, you know, if I wasn't on the radio, it would have not been, I only developed the act after we all got fired 6 years later and I went on the road for the Comedy Zone and was forced to do real comedy for a couple of years all throughout the South at all the Comedy Zone stuff. And that's where I really grew and learned the craft of that.
Okay.
Even my six-year tenure at WMMR, I really was just a weekend, you know, it was kind of like a side thing for me, although I did pay attention to it quite a bit, you know, but it was not, I didn't get good and or bomb-proof until I got fired and was forced to be a real comedian doing it all the time.
Who were some people that were coming into the radio show that you just loved, you were excited to meet?
Randy Newman.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was such a huge fan, and I had written, he had made a comment about Brian Wilson that his album wasn't being promoted. They were both in Warner Brothers, and we know that Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys has issues and stuff.
Yeah.
And Randy Newman said in Rolling Stone, they're not putting a whole lot of money into my new album. They're putting money into Brian Wilson's album, which is recorded. They just stuck a microphone in front of him and said, sing, potato, sing. The man's a vegetable. And I thought, oh, my gosh. So I wrote a song called Sing, Potato, Sing, mm-hmm. in Randy Newman style. We didn't know that Randy Newman would listen to radio, and he had a way to listen at that point at Warner Brothers, and he heard about this Sing, Potato, Sing, and we had a chance to interview him. And Randy added a verse to it, and we had a chance to sing it and perform it together.
Unbelievable.
And he was the funniest. He was fantastic. And he, because I wrote the song, he said the lick that I had was a pretty cool little piano lick. And I'm a piano basher. He's an actual piano player. Mm-hmm. I write on the piano. I write on the guitar. You know, even when we record now, I leave it to the professionals. I stay out of it. I just use those instruments to write with. I'm not technically that good. Randy is. But Randy said to me, he goes, that piano riff you had, boy, I wish I had that. You know, I said, really? Because that's a good riff. But you work the pedal too hard like I do. And he was just funny like that. And then we would go on the air with him. And it was just like, that's my favorite interview of all time.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I remember him knocking on YouTube. Yeah, Bono, they're talking against war, I guess, right? Like who's for? You know, like who's for war? He would knock. He was so funny about ELO. He would rag on them. I found him to be incredibly charming and funny. He talked about The Natural because he did the soundtrack to
yes.
The Natural.
Yeah.
So he was telling us on air that he had an argument with Redford. because when the lights flash in that one scene, I wrote trumpets and horns. And Redford said, "No, I don't want those instruments in there." And I said, "What do you want me to put in there? A kazoo?" I remember little things like that, like his inside showbiz stuff.
Yeah,
and he talked about his dad because his dad and his uncles write soundtracks, Lionel Newman and all those guys. If you ever see the Newman name, he has a lot of family that came up in the business. And he always was looking for his dad to approve of him, and he was telling us this great story in our production room, not on air, because we were listening to It's Money That Matters, which was one of his hits.
Mm-hmm.
And he said he did the video, and he played it for his dad. And he goes, my dad said, do you have a cold? He goes, he can still hurt me to this day.
No kid, yeah.
Do you have a cold? Randy Newman, obviously the nasal, he's been singing like that.
Right.
Do you have a cold?
Oh.
And I remember going, God, I love this guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, people like that. And then on the other hand, there were people that were, you know, oh, geez.
Yeah, and those stories are less interesting to me. I know there's a...
Oh, I know.
I know there's a...
There's the flip side to it.
There's a public craving for, man, who was the biggest jerk?
Yeah, I like to scream joy about the ones that were just, would shock me, but Paul McCartney, so sweet, Eric Clapton, I thought that was going to go weird, and it was just, he was just the sweetest guy.
Oh, good, yeah.
I had a lot of wonderful experiences.
Yeah. A-plus celebrities you're dealing with daily.
Yeah, we were.
Yeah.
We were. Yeah. And it was kind of mind-blowing. You know, Seinfeld would come through before his TV show. He had been on Carson the night before, did the red eye, and was gracious enough to get up. And Dennis Miller, who I love, came in and did our show. And it was interesting to see. I remember DeBella saying to him, hey, can you do that news thing you do for me? And I remember Dennis shaking his head like he didn't want to work. Him taking a newspaper, circling stuff, writing some stuff down, and he kills it for us in 10 minutes' time. While a song was being played, he wrote out like an update for us.
Wow. Because
DeBella said... Hey, can you? And I remember the look on Dennis Miller's face, who I just adored, and I still do. I just love his writing. I like the albums, and I was really thrilled to meet him. And he just did this for us right on the spot. It was interesting. And Gilbert Gottfried would come through and kill Bobcat.
It's a tough question. If we were in here and Dennis Miller walked in and Tom said, "Hey, Dennis, why don't you write a?" Tom wouldn't do this.
No,
but if he's "Hey, why don't you write us a quick weekend update?" We would, we would all cringe because we go, this guy got up early to come in. He's not, he just wants to hang and talk.
Well, you know, here's what DeBella would do. He goes, if we had somebody, we would hear from their publicist, Elvis Costello's not playing, Alice Cooper's not playing, John Anderson from Yes isn't playing. And DeBella would go, hey, give him the God. Pete Townsend is not playing. He doesn't want to play in the morning. It's not the right time for his voice. And DeBella would go to me, you got this? I said, I got this. So we'd have the guitar and the piano. Pete Townsend from The Who, for example.
Yeah.
We're over in London doing a series of live shows, and I'm writing a song about a guy who had sex with a cat on us on the tube. And I remember scribbling away and singing this thing, and I know of someone sitting next to me, but I'm not really concerned with it. And Pete Townsend says, are you allowed to write that? You know, I said, he heard me singing something about the cat. Yeah, it's kind of my job. And he laughed. So we created something before we went on the air.
Yeah.
Because he was shocked that I was, are you guys allowed to get away with that? And I said, yeah. We go on the air, and DeBella gives me like the wink that Townsend doesn't see because he wants them to play.
Yeah.
And I have my black Takamine there. And I go, you know, Pete, I love the opening to Pinball Wizard. It's very Baroque. Those chord changes are wonderful. But I've always struggled with, and I remember him furrowing his brow and watching my hands, right? So I play the opening to it, and I know the opening to it. I nailed it. Dum, 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 dum. And halfway through, he goes, you know it. He goes, he grabs the guitar from me and plays Pinball Wizard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, just moments like that we tricked Eddie Money into playing because the piano and the guitar were there. And he had said, okay, I'll do two tickets to Paradise for you. Hey, yeah, they'll have this guy play guitar. Make sure you really bang it. I'll play the piano. And he did two tickets to Paradise on piano.
Yeah.
So we would get people because the instruments were there to kind of do stuff they weren't ready to do.
You know what? But they love doing.
They love
it. So that's the key there is you would trick them, yes, but... deep down, it's who they are. It's what they do. It's what they love.
Well, you always do when someone says science, you go, science. And this, of course, it's from a Thomas Dolby song. Yeah. And we had him on, and he refused to play because he was a craftsman in the studio and still is. And that was where his art form came from, was the studio. He wasn't necessarily a live performer. Mm-hmm. But DeBella had said, hey, why don't you, you and Pat put together a little promo for us? I remember Dolby, like, he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to do it at all. But darn it, if he didn't, we didn't go next door and he got the drum machine and did some, and we did like a little jingle together. And it was wonderful.
Wow.
And but he did it on his own terms. He went to the other room for 20 minutes, and we crafted this little thing, and he came back with like an MMR jingle that they used forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. So whenever you say science, I always go back to that moment yeah. with Dolby refusing to perform.
That's
there was,
great.
There were fun times.
Now, when Miller came in, he teased you a little bit, right?
Yeah.
I love this.
Well,
because Miller talks about this now.
Yeah.
He loves goofing around with comedians, and he's a ball buster, and he loves that camaraderie.
Well, the night before he did our show, I opened for him at the TLA, and my act was not conducive to opening. People would say, you make it messy out there. You turn it into a bar, not a comedy club. And they're absolutely right.
It can. Yes, that can happen.
It can happen.
Right.
Raucous barroom comedy.
Right.
Which, so... Dennis Miller came in for the last thing, which at that time was that Springsteen improv bit, which always did pretty well. Mm-hmm. And see, so he saw it messy and kind of a. So I had the guitar around my and he always would introduce himself like he didn't know him. It was this, hey, hi, I'm Dennis Miller. And I go, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he and what's your name? And he looked down at my guitar, Hank. and I laughed, and he didn't say like good job. He just went. He walked away.
That's his way of saying good job.
So the next morning he came in, and I'm dressed differently, and he has no. And I could tell that he probably may have gone out with his wife afterwards, and he could have been a little hungover and smelling of either cologne that had alcohol than it had alcohol. Okay. I sensed a presence.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
He was hungover, but still very, very funny. And so he does the same kind of intro to me. He goes, "Hi, I'm Dennis Miller." And I went.
He didn't recognize you from.
Nope.
Okay.
No. I said, yeah, I know. I met you last night. My name's Hank. He goes, I deserve that. And then he killed.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, DeBella sometimes wasn't as knowledgeable as we were. I'll give you an example. Tim Allen is at the Comedy Factory Outlet. Mm-hmm. And I got to get up the next day, but I get a call from Clay Hurry, the owner. You got to come down and see this guy. He's got to be on the show tomorrow. I've never seen an act like this. This guy has everything in its place. Now, I saw it on Wednesday night, and I just thought, but this is a hell of an act. You got to have him on the show. So I drag my ass down the three blocks to the Comedy Factory Outlet, and I see Tim Allen before Home Improvement.
Yeah.
Before anything. Just a road warrior out of Detroit.
Yeah.
Kill with that act. Men are pigs.
Yeah.
All the stuff you see in that first special that Home Improvement's based on. And I'm like, holy crap. And we get introduced. He was a drinker then. I had to get up in the morning. And he had said to me, hey, I would really love to do your show tonight. You want to go out for a drink? I said, I can't, but you're on the show. You're on the show. Well, he's at the Days Inn on Delaware Avenue. And he goes, he gives me the number and everything. And okay, I just got to talk to my guy, and I'll give you a buzz in the morning. You get in the cab. We'll probably see you about 7 o'clock. He goes, great. Thank you so much for being able to promote the show. Tim Allen is just being nice and kissing ass in a great way, and wanting to be a buddy. And because he was a guy's guy.
Yeah.
And we have our meeting at 5, and I go and I start off the meeting. Oh my God, Clay had me come down and see this Tim Allen guy. And you cannot believe how good this guy is. So I think we should probably have him on the show. And DeBella goes, oh. So you're booking the show now? I said, no, Clay had me come down and I talked to Clay.
Yeah.
I'm not going to wake up, Clay. You're not booking the show. I can't have people I don't know on the... I said, John, this guy's great. I've already told him he could go. Well, you're going to have to tell him he's not. So I have to call Tim Allen at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning at the hotel and tell him, I go, hey, I'm really sorry, but DeBella doesn't want to have you on. And he was real gracious. Tim Allen... 6 months away from doing Home Improvement, I have to tell him he can't do our morning zoo show.
Wow. So Home Improvement comes out. What does DeBella say, or do you say to him?
Well, I would bust his ass.
Yeah.
Did you see Home Improvement, the number one show the other night with that Tim Allen? Have you seen Santa Claus? Because you have to understand it. When Home Improvement came out, he had home run after a home run. Yeah. This is before Toy Story, because we're going back to it. But I would just go, Home Improvement, because it was the number one show in the country.
Yeah.
And he obviously was still doing clubs, but had the development deal, and he must have had the pilot in the can. But he wasn't talking about that. He just wanted to promote the show because he had a door deal at the Comedy Factory outlet. But tell him Tim Allen he can't do our show.
Oh, what a bummer.
And I've almost run into him because he would hang out at the Comedy Castle up in Detroit and stuff, and I'd like miss him by a week. I always want to kind of see him and apologize and kind of laugh at that story.
Yeah.
But I never was able to run into him at any. Oh, he's huge, obviously, but he would make appearances up in Detroit from time to time.
I'd like to think that he would pat you on the shoulder and go, "Everything worked out."
You know, I have never felt. Oh my God.
Yeah, that's tough.
You know, DeBella didn't know who Bill Hicks was.
Okay.
So I remember we had the cast of O Calcutta in, and they're all naked. And it's Bill Hicks. And he had an album out that I just adored. And I told John all about it. And John did allow Bill Hicks, who he did not know. This is a year before Bill Hicks passes away. So he's probably 31, mm-hmm. 30 or 31. And he's not sick yet. And and I didn't know that he was a guitar player and enjoyed music and stuff. So we have the cast of O Calcutta. And there are naked women all around me as I'm singing a parody of Oklahoma. Oh, Calcutta, where the, you know. And as I'm singing, I see Bill Hicks in like a window that we have in the studio, peering in and looking at the naked women and me. And we don't know each other. And he's shaking his head, looking at me, going, he's really being funny.
Yeah, oh, you know? Okay, yeah, yeah.
And then he makes, the door opens and he's introduced to all of us, but he makes a beeline for me. I got the guitar.
Yeah.
And I guess he just kind of, and he just said, "This is how you make a living. Right? Naked women, oh, Calcutta." I said, "Yeah." And he was fantastic.
Yeah.
And then he ended up hanging out with us and like talking music and stuff with me and the production guy, Steve. And a year later, he passes away of pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
Boom, at 32.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The world just got to know him.
Yes.
You know, before he passed away.
It's the oddest thing for him now. I hear young comedians. I have a friend who writes Bill Hicks in his hand every time before he does a show. Just to remind him to stay true to his art. To be dark. Don't be afraid of being dark. Don't be afraid of being yourself.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of taking chances.
Because he would alienate.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he took some chances. And my friend writes Bill Hicks in his hand. And I've never had, you know, there are some stories I don't tell because people just don't believe them. It's a younger comedian. And I go, and I almost, you know, I forget it. He's not, you know, I actually met Bill Hicks.
Yeah.
These kids, what? Because you know how the younger guys, they adore the Mitch Hedbergs and Bill Hicks, of course.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So when you
should share that story with those guys because you would love hearing those stories.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, but there are sometimes, you know, even when I'm watching TV, like my ex-wife and I, she would play the game if there was a show on, a sitcom or on. All right. Who opened for you? Who do you know? Oh, that guy opened for me back in Minnesota.
Yeah.
I know. And she always got a kick out of it. And then sure. I would be real honest with her. Do you know that? No, I never met that person. Because there's some people that, you know, like Robin Williams, all of my friends have met. I never, ever got it close. But all of my friends have like a Robin Williams story.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's interesting when you can look at TV and see your buddies or people that have opened for you and you kind of get a little jealous sometimes. Or you think, oh, geez, maybe I should have stayed out in LA a little bit longer.
Yeah. Who do you still want to meet?
Oh, man, that's an excellent question. Who do I still want to meet? I mean, I think there are some people that have passed away I would have loved to have met. I would have loved to have met Richard Pryor because I listened to his Mudbone stuff or anything by him. And it's hard on me because it's so good. I honestly, I want to quit sometimes. I listen to it like, oh, my God, that long form comedy. I listen to some of those things and I'm such a fan if I had a chance to just meet him. Because I've met Paul McCartney there. You know, I've met like a lot of people.
Yeah.
I've pissed Elton John off twice in my life. And Elton John, no, I swear to God, I got to meet my idol twice. And accidentally blew it the first time and then really blew it the second time.
Well, you've got to tell us.
Well, we're in London, the time that the Pete Townsend story I just told you, and we're at the airport, and I got the timeline right. This is 3 months before he gets sober. He was working the Reading Music Festival, And my buddy, we called him the Beastmaster, was our intern.
Mm-hmm.
And he's in front of me in line at British Airways. And okay. we're flying to Paris. We're on vacation now for 2 weeks. We're going to be a weekend in Paris and a weekend in Nice. And I'm traveling with an ugly American. But he's hilarious.
Yeah.
But he's loud. Hey, it's Robert Plant. And sure enough, Robert Plant is walking down over here because it was a Reading Music Festival.
Yeah.
And I did see Robert Plant, but at first I thought he was messing with me. Oh, you're right. That is Robert Plant.
Yeah.
Now, he knew Elton John was, I was, this is how I, why I started in this business.
Yeah.
Was Elton John. He goes, and he turns around looking because our line ain't moving. He goes, Elton John's behind you. I went, yeah, Elton John's not behind me. And I turn around, and Elton John is behind me with a hat on, a long-billed cap that said boy toy.
Okay, yeah. And, I mean, he couldn't be more Elton John.
And a bedazzled boy toy with a long bill.
Yeah.
And he looks rough.
Okay.
I think the wig is askew. There are many valises around him, and he is by himself, and he is irritated.
Okay.
And I see someone back at the British Airways behind the counter like this. Oh, and they're getting it together, and they're doing this and this. And,
yeah.
And
he shouldn't be in line with everybody.
And my
else.
Friend Howard, the Beastmaster, Howard Lavin, goes, "Yeah, you got to get his autograph." No. I said, "Leave him alone. Leave him alone."
Yeah, yeah.
And Howard goes, "No, you can't let this moment go." And I go, "No, don't."
The little devil on your shoulder.
Well, during the meantime, Elton at Piggy, he was Elvis at that
time.
Yeah,
he was. To me.
he has gathered his valises, many valises, and he has like a handbag up here and a purse over here and bags.
Just juggling all
this. Yes,
these.
And my buddy goes, "Hey," he calls him Mr. John, "can we get your autograph?" And I turn around, and he loses it. He curses. He's throwing crap. He's throwing everything around, and Howard grabbed. I don't know where he grabbed. I don't know where he grabbed a piece of paper. I have the autograph. He gave him a blank piece of paper. I think we had to wait for that. And Elton is livid, and he scribbles this thing and he throws it at us. He picks up his valises and he went on his merry way. And Howard goes, "You got your autograph." That's not the experience I wanted with him. Now. I go to L.A. For the third time. L.A. 3, Pat Godwin 0. So I go to L.A. the third time, and my adorable girlfriend is working on Rodeo Drive, and they're having their Christmas party at Mr. Chow, which is
famous.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Great Chinese food. And she says, "Pat, Kyle, we're going to rip it up. Come at 11 and gather me and throw me in the car and we'll go home." And I said, yeah, you girls have a great time. It's their Christmas party. So I walk into Mr. Chow, and next to my girlfriend's rowdy table is the sober Elton John, his future husband Mark, and another gentleman who I don't know. There's three men there. Yeah. And and my girlfriend is sitting right next. Her back is to Elton John.
Okay.
And I'm like, "Oh, Jesus, Elton John."
Yeah, yeah.
So I sit down next to my girlfriend, and now Elton John is right here. Their tables are very close together. They're not right now due to the conditions of the corona, but then people were close
sure,
to
yeah,
each other.
Yeah.
So I said to my girlfriend, Kim, they're all named Kim. Yeah. This is Kim Rubinson. Do you know that Elton John is right next? Yeah, he's really nice. We were talking to him earlier. You guys are a little loud. Are you annoying there too? No, he's really cool. You should say hi. And at that moment, I went, I'm not going to bring up the Heathrow incident at British Airways.
Right.
But what the hell? I'll try again. And I go, Elton, can I call you Elton? Why, of course. And I go, this is going well.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't mean. And he is eating. And I don't. Mm-hmm. I probably shouldn't have done that. But I just want to be really brief. I just want to tell you that you're the reason why I'm here. You're the reason why I do what I do. And I just wanted to thank you for that. What a nice, and everyone, like, they all light up. What a nice thing to say.
Yeah.
That's very nice. Thank you very much. What's your name? My name's Pat. I just want to tell you, you're the reason why I do what I do. He says, "What do you do?" I said, "Funny music." And he gets, his face goes red. "What? Funny music?" And everybody at his table gets quiet. His future husband gets quiet. And it's on. He is pissed. I said, "Well, no. What about my music? will make you think it's funny?" I said, "No. Do you think I'm funny? Well, I've seen your interviews. You can be very, very, very funny. Is my music funny to you? He is. It's like the Joe Pesci thing, yeah. But he ain't messing with me. Right. He's really, really mad. And then I thought, oh, God, I can save this. And this may sound jokey. And I said, well, you know, in your song, your opening line is it's a little bit funny. And it gets nothing. It gets nothing. Yeah. And he is mad. And he goes, well, it's pleasure meeting you, like that. And I swiveled my chair around and I went, I totally pissed off Elton John a second time. I remember that he ate fast like Tom does. Like Elton John was really enjoying his food. I just remember looking over and scarfing up really food like he just got out of jail. Yeah. I just had lunch with Tom today and I forgot how fast he eats.
Yes. Yeah.
I think our lunch lasted 3 minutes. I'm not even joking. We ate and he was up and out. All right. We're not even talking. I got songs to run by you.
Yes. Cause a lot of, we go to his favorite place and they know his order. So they don't even, there's no talking during that. They just bring
what he eats like he got out of jail.
Yeah.
He takes 3 phone calls. Hold on. I gotta, yeah. It'll be one of his children. Yeah. I pissed off Elton John twice.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah. So how did this come to an end? You've said you all were fired.
Oh, yeah. Well, Stern finally beat us.
Okay.
And beat us good. But we're still number two. And when you're number two in the market, you can still bill at a pretty good rate for advertising.
Yes.
So there was no reason to panic. But our radio station panicked. This would have been 94. And so WMMR had a contract with DiBella, who's making probably $1.3 million, you know, and we were all, as side people, doing pretty well, but our contracts weren't as secure. Mm-hmm. So everybody was let go, and DiBella stayed and tried a thing called Sports Rock, which he did with a local sports newscaster. And that was Pat Croce. I don't know if you know Pat Croce is, but he owned the 76ers for a while.
Okay.
And has a bunch of restaurants. But, I mean, you know, people like that. He did a sports rock show, and that failed. But he ran out his contract.
I got you.
He now works across the street, I think, at Eagle 106 or Magic 106 or something. He's at a different station now in the morning. He's still there doing radio.
Yeah.
So we all got fired. And then at that point, Stern, who had done a funeral party for us and 40,000 people out in front by the Liberty Bell while we're upstairs, you know, and he came into town, and it was his first funeral. And he called him Baldy, and they had a bald mannequin in the coffin. And it was ugly. And DiBella just refused to fight back. And so it was a very, very awkward time.
Yeah.
And not to mention the fact that my brother has a relationship with John DiBella's ex-wife, soon-to-be ex-wife, which made it very uncomfortable for me to work with John and when my brother is sleeping with his ex-wife. So it was a wonderful time in my life. Thank God we got fired because we would have killed each other. I get a phone call from Stern's people, specifically Gary Delabate, Baba Booey.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, did you notice Howard never, ever, because he used to go after our show and John. But, you know, and Gary calls me up. He finds me somehow. He knew that we were all fired and says, do you know, Howard never went after you because he really likes your work. Would you like to do stuff for us? I said, yes.
Okay.
So he was talking about Aaron Neville and that thing on his face. And my first thing for them was what is that thing on Aaron Neville's face, which he played constantly. He just loved that song. Took me with him on many trips. He would fly places, and he was now beating everybody. So his next conquest was Cleveland, and I went on the plane there and did that and did a couple songs and the live thing. I would do the E! Show. And I would send him songs, goofing on Baba Booey and people, Fred, and it would be stuff that was just about their show.
Yeah.
Nothing I could use in my act.
But did you move to New York City?
No. I was just doing the road at that time, and I would go into their radio station affiliates and record, use their equipment, and send him stuff from the road. I did a song about his wife, Allison, I did a Elvis Costello parody. But I did mainly original things for him that he liked, and then went on a live trip with them and did their – he had the E! Show at the time, and I was featured on that a couple times. And it was really interesting to work in – because that was – he was on the cover of Rolling Stone at that time. And I went from MMR being so successful to being now – I felt like when I traveled with them – the level that it went, it was like the Beatles. He was on the cover of Rolling Stone. Yes. Private Parts was about to come out, mm-hmm. and he couldn't have been bigger. And here I am on the plane. David Lee Roth is on the plane. The Buttafuoco's are sitting next to me. And I'm like, what? How did I get here?
Yeah.
And, you know, it caused a lot of problems with some of my friends in Philly who thought I kind of turned my back on DeBell right. and everybody. But the truth is, DeBell and I were fighting for the last couple of years over content in the show and things like that. And then the situation with my brother and other really unfortunate things. It just felt kind of natural to, you know, to go to the Stern thing. But, God, it was kind of a... It was pretty heady, and it's time for me to do something like that.
Yeah.
So all of Philadelphia was kind of buzzing about that. So it was interesting. The show's changed from being like people yelling out MMR stuff to now it was like the Stern stuff, which was not relatable and a little too harsh. Like I don't know if you know Mancow from Chicago.
Yeah, I'm definitely aware of
his father passed away, and Stern had me do a thing about his dad. I remember telling Fred. Geez, this is a little rough because I would send them stuff and they'd rewrite. Mm-hmm. And Fred would put, oh, I go, can you not say my name on this one? You know, because I can't even say some of the stuff that, you know, this person's father passed away. And
right.
they were just ruthless.
Yeah.
But as people off air, they were not. Stern was the nicest guy, you know, always asking about you. He wasn't all about him. He was soft spoken. And then you go on the air and it's like, whoa, Jesus. And the stuff that I did kind of feels whorish now to look back and go, oh, I wish I didn't do that song.
How long did you work for them?
Well, I never got paid. I just did songs for them, and I got my name mentioned quite a bit. That would have been from 94 until the first time I did Bob and Tom. And Tom and I kind of were instant friends, and he said, you know, I'd like it if you didn't do that show ever again. I said, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because he was very, very, I guess Stern came into the Bob and Tom market and started to go after Tom a little bit.
Yeah.
So when I would, when he heard of my lineage and the fact that I'd worked with Stern, he never really, I said, you know, he's actually a nice guy. He goes, he never really wanted to hear that conversation. I don't know what Stern said, but Tom being such a family man, it may have been something family related. But he took me aside and said, you know, I'd like it if you do stuff with us and you never, you know, do the Stern show. So. I haven't done it since.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've kept in contact with those guys, Gary specifically, Delabati Baba Booey, because he's really a nice guy. You'd love him.
Yeah.
You know, big famous Baba Booey thing all over the country. He's got right. a book out and stuff, but he's a really good producer, and he gets teased quite a bit. He's actually a very nice guy.
Check out the podcast that inspired Taylor Sheridan's latest series, Landman.
There's a stretch of road in oil-rich region of West Texas. This region of West Texas, known as the Permian Basin, is in the midst of the biggest oil boom in history. This is a story of roughnecks, billionaire wildcatters, and wannabe dreamers. My name is Christian Wallace. From Texas Monthly and Imperative Entertainment, this is Boomtown.
Boomtown.
Follow and listen on your favorite platform.